You're listening to Renegade Broadcasting.
I think that's my cue. Welcome everybody to the wild card. This is Monday, March 6, 2017. And I want to welcome everybody to the show tonight. And also I want to remind everybody to go check out Renegade Tribune, where articles are put out every day. Good source of information, excellent source of information. So, this is Hadis, and I'll be your host tonight. And thanks, John Smith, and from the chat. And tonight I'm going to be going to do kind of like some overview stuff regarding the Jewish Holocaust, also known as the Holocaust. And I'm going to go over some things probably some of us haven't heard so much, and some things probably you have. I've got several articles here. I'm going to start out one from the Tribune, and got some from Holocaust handbooks, and one in an older kind of a pamphlet, I guess it was put out in 1974, but I'll get back to that. So tonight I want to start out with reading Holocrap from the Renegade Tribune. It's put out a little while ago, earlier this month or earlier last month, by Digger for Truth, and it's an excellent synopsis of 20 definitive reasons why the Jewish Holocaust is a pile of steaming horse dung shit crap. So we'll be going over that, and yeah, I think it's always good to review fundamentals, so this is going to be a little bit of an exercise in that. When in doubt, just go over the basics. So, as we know, the Holocaust, Holocrap, Holohoax has been used by the Jews, for the Jews, against mostly everybody else for their own selfish, sickening reasons. And basically, the storyline is a hoax based on lies and fabrications of truth pictures in the past that have been manipulated, and quite a result in the past 70 years plus that has taken place regarding this massive deceptive lie that the Jews have created. And so I'll start reading this. So Digger for Truth: this huge lie in history must be exposed and decimated. Think of all the innocent good people who have and are currently spending time behind bars just for questioning this ridiculous fable. This humongous lie is a buffer for the plethora of Jewish criminality. Once this global fib gets exposed, which it is will, then it will be the beginning of the end for this tyrannical cult. That is why it is essential that we all make efforts to expose this insult to history, insult to the truth, and an insult to all who have really suffered under this Judaic beast. These 20 reasons are my personal choices, bigger for truth, so I know the Holocaust to be a lie. I'm not saying these are the most important damning evidence, but just obvious common sense reasons why one realizes the Holocaust is in fact a hall of hoax. These points are deliberately concise and not in order of importance, nor are they particularly academic or scientific. They're just meant as reminders to those aware of this hoax and a teaser for newcomers to this truth. So if you're new to this information, this is a really good place to start. You could jump off of this, springboard off of this, and it really gets quite intense as far as the details and whatnot, and it's quite astounding the level of scholarly research these men have, I guess mostly men, have put out. And kind of, I guess the irony, or one irony of it all, is that it's not really basing on anything, quote, anti-Semitic. It's just research of exposing this disgusting, sickening lie of the Jews. So that's kind of an interesting aspect. But so we can get on with this here. So number one, pink. Lobster pink is the color of a corpse from cyanide and carbon monoxide poisoning, the two gases supposedly used by the evil, evil, evil Nazis. Both gases block body oxygen absorption. Therefore, the corpses, being full of oxygen, oxyhemoglobin, turn into a pink red. All reports claim to have only seen blue-greenish colored corpses by all the witnesses, even testified at the Nuremberg trials. And that doesn't include the colored smoke coming out of the chimneys. So number two is blue. Prussian blue is the color of stained walls left as residue from iron deposits from the cyanide gas, as were the walls in the delousing chambers. Cyanide was used only to delouse the clothing of the inmates and certainly not for killing Jews. And this is why no blue staining appears in the supposed gas chambers claimed by the Jews. Fred Lechter and others have done scientific experiments to prove this. Although, again, one does not need to be an expert to see the obvious. And in our culture, we are lacking critical examination of things, severely lacking that. However, these independent scientists and revisionists are tremendously useful in standing up to the mainstream, mind-controlled, and compromised academics. Three, the International Red Cross were regular, spontaneous visitors to the supposed death camps. This alone should ring alarm bells to newcomers to this ridiculous fairy tale. Why would a humanitarian organization wish to pay visits to a death camp? And what did they find? They found healthy, nutritional food served to healthy inmates, prisoners. That's it. No deformed bodies, no piles of lobster-colored nor blue-green corpses, nor experimental chambers. The real singer for me in this is that the Jews were receiving far better nutrition than the Germans and other Aryans who were suffering outside these camps, and all caused in the first place by collective Jewry. God, you couldn't make this shit up. So yeah, I agree. It seems to me that the work camps are probably the safest place to be in World War II, except until the end, and you could stay free from typhus. Number four, Jew mathematics. The actual figure of 6 million deaths, 600,000 deaths due to gassing and shooting is quite preposterous. This magic figure has been cited 166 times from 1900 to 1945, with claims of or alluding to torment or torture of Jews. When the reality is there are more than Jews after the war than before. Now get a pen and paper and try to work the math out equation to this. There have been 5,360,710 claims from so-called Holocaust survivors. Let's take a look at this. 4 million Jews under Hitler's government, but somehow 6 million died, and then 5 million remained to claim compensation. Now that's Jew mathematics. These lying bastards want empathy and reparations. It matters not that the figures do not equate. Five, taboo. If you dare even show a sniff of doubt that 2 + 2 = 5, Big Brother will incarcerate you. And that's where we're at. If you simply question this ridiculous myth of the Holocaust religion in 17 countries, you will go to prison under hate crimes law, legislation, not actual law. That fact alone should ring very loud alarm bells to anyone looking into this myth. Because surely, if this atrocity on the Jews really did happen and could easily be backed up by real history and real scientific evidence, then surely this debate should be transparent for all to see. this Holocaust really did happen, then the Jews would be the first to want to make a mockery of all the non-Jewish revisionists. That would be their ultimate trump card. As with all history and science and any area of study, we need to be able to independently review and revise it. Yet somehow this hot topic is a closed case, written in stone, never to be questioned. With any academic questioning, the hollow religion demonized and outed from his career. How convenient. To me, this point alone is enough to highlight the Holocaust as a sham. Facilities, number 6. In the so-called Auschwitz death camp, where the evil, evil, nasty Nazis were gassing the poor victim Jews, they inappropriately had the following facilities: swimming pool, theater for music and drama, kindergartens, orchestra, library, art museum, football pitch, sports relay events, post office, where the death victims could write postcards to the outside world, hospital medical unit to make people better before they get killed, Auschwitz currency, brothel, underfloor heated quarters, canteens, kitchen, and a bakery. Whew, that's some death camp, eh? And any officer who harmed you was punished. There were strict legal measures set in place in order that no mistreatment of inmates would occur. It was not beneficial to harm the valuable labor force. 7, logistics. Why would the Germans invest so much precious energy and time transporting millions of Jews to death camps in wartime? Why? What would be the logic for this insane logistics? Think of the cost of the fuel alone. If the Germans really wanted to kill off all these Jews, why did they just locally round up the Jews and kill them there? This would have been much more productive and economical. The Germans were not stupid, and in fact were excellent strategists. It makes no sense if one believes this ridiculous fairy tale. Yet it makes perfect sense if the Germans simply wanted to remove the Jews from Europe due to their destructive, parasitic nature and place them in labor camps to assist their defense. The Germans needed as much labor as possible during the war to make ammunition in stock. It would have made sense that they would use the perpetrators of this war to compensate in way of enforced labor. That's what every army has done throughout history. 8, coke. Likewise, in regards to reserving fuel, why would Germans waste so much precious fuel in burning millions of bodies using up mountains of coke when this coke could have been used to fight the war? Remember, the Germans were in a desperate situation with fuel embargoes and economy of resources were paramount. It is a ludicrous suggestion to think that they would waste this on gassing and burning stupid Jews, which can be utilized for precious labor instead, not to mention the time and effort used to do this. And where are the aerial shots of the mountains of coke which have been needed to consume these furnaces and gas chambers? There are thousands of aerial shots taken of the work camps throughout the war. None show any extraordinary coke reserves, nor do any of the detailed paperwork show any stockpiling of large amounts of coke. If the Germans wanted to kill off Jews, as the kosher narrative goes, then they could have simply rounded them up in locations, starved them with food and water. That would have been the most economical and quickest solution without any fuel whatsoever. Exactly what happened in Eisenhower's Jew camp to the German POWs, where he basically rounded them up, put them in a pen, and starved them all to death. Do school children hear about this atrocity? 9, newspapers. Who can trust the media? Even normals out there know deep down that the newspapers and general media are lying to them, even though they habitually keep consuming these lies. And who owns the media? Newspapers, mainly local, magazines, TV, cinema, Arabs, Irish, prior Christians? No. It's the Jews. And everyone secretly knows this fact. The Jews run everything. So we have a Jewish-owned media perpetually giving us this narrative, religious doctrine, of the 4-6 million victims and survivors. And we're all supposed to believe it. Don't forget the Jews have control of the academic world, too. Kindergarten, junior high, senior high school, colleges, universities, home study courses, industrial training courses, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. They got their sickening parasitic ways into everything. And we're supposed to believe all this is not going to affect our cognitive thinking ability to independently come up with our own reasoning to what really happened. And when did this narrative suddenly appear in our society? Did the press report these findings at the time of the supposed death camps? No. But instead, it began to creep out in the 70s. How bizarre. If one quizzes elderly people whether they heard of Holocaust death camps in the late 40s and 50s, they will tell you the truth, that there was no social talk of death camps, because this fabricative narrative didn't really come about into the psyche of people until decades later. 10, producer gas. The fact that there were over 500,000 producer gas vehicles all over Germany and other parts of Europe, and the utter simplicity of the design of a producer gas generator renders the use of diesel exhaust or Zycon B is as idiotic as trying to start a fire by rubbing two sticks together in a match factory. Nicholas Kellerstrom. 3, airtight. The elementary fact, supposed gas chamber, excuse me, airtight. The elementary fact that the supposed gas chambers had a flimsy wooden door with a glass window and drains for the gas to escape is a bit of an easy giveaway. If one is to use a pinch of logic and not use one's emotions, dogma, and enforced conditioning, the wooden door in the facility, which would need to be super airtight, is beyond ridiculous. And to think billions across the planet, including myself at one time and me, have fallen for this horse crap. 12, fake chimney. The chimney at Auschwitz is merely a prop. It was built in 1946 by Stalin. That's after the war, by the way. After the period of the supposed Holocaust. And it isn't even physically connected to the building. It's just a freestanding, symbolic, non-functioning chimney. I suppose all that matters to the masses is the illusion. After all, this whole world seems to be one big illusory existence. Altered reality will do for the masses just as long as they're in their comfort zone and amongst the herd. 13, emotions versus facts. When one dares to discuss this exceptionally raw topic, the immediate defiant reaction from most people is, well, what about the piles of skeletal bodies they were piling up with a bulldozer? And they deliver this one-off statement as if they know, as if they've got unshakable evidence. Well, what about them? They were simply piles of bodies. This whole hollow religion is built on emotions. The music, the weeping sentimental eyewitness, paid off Jews and symbolism, the shoes, the railway tracks, the shaved hair, none of it is evidence. It's just symbolism around a fabricated narrative. When a Jew stands next to a railway track and the Talmud vision with sentimental music, we immediately get triggered into empathy mode. When the reality is just a Jew standing next to a railroad track. It's only when one dares to take out one's emotions and look at the actual evidence from independently resourced facts with logic and reason and common sense, then all these symbols and dreary music have stopped having effect. The piles of shoes are simply donations by kind, caring Germans. The shaved hair were simply shaved hair, carried out for pragmatic reasons to prevent lice in the camps. And the piles of bodies were just piles of emaciated bodies of non-Jews and Jews who were abundant at the time due to typhoid rampant in the camps, due to the Jewish-funded American attacks on the infrastructures, preventing foods getting into the camps. So blame the fucking Jews. There were thousands of bodies like this all over Germany and Europe due to food embargoes and mass bombing raids and farms and general infrastructure. Just look at the starving of the civilians in the streets of Germany at the end of the war, all caused by international Jewry. But interesting enough, the film director Billy Wilder, who created the footage of these camps, just happened to be Jewish. Yes, how convenient. Now, I wonder if he had any bias. 14, Nuremberg. When you think of the Nuremberg trials, think of kangaroo. Think of fraud and deception. The biggest public legal trickery in modern history. Jews lies at their best. If ever there was a case of justice, lack of justice, it was in these sham trials. The lampshades as evidence, the false testimonies of SS officers who had their lives threatened, their families threatened, having to give testimony as force of alcohol, having their balls crushed. It was imperative that the Jews got this trial to go the way they wanted, because it was their trial that was on global display for all their Jewish media to report on. He set the precedents for the Holocaust religion to begin. From this fake trial, the whole world will be put on a mass guilt trip. 15, why the tattoos? Why the hell would you go to the effort to tattoo people whom you intend to murder? Or is that a silly question? I really would like to hear the explanation for this, Jew. I have heard that the nasty Nazis first used the Jews' labor and burnt them out, than destroying them. But would you really go to the effort of constantly replacing and retraining your workforce? And as discussed, the cost and time involved in destroying this workforce would be phenomenal in war times. Why not just look after your workforce, as the Germans did, in order to get better production from them? Logic. 16, pits and piles. Where are the mass death pits that the Jews speak of? And how about the tons and tons of ash piles? Where are they? Remember, we are talking large volumes here. We're talking 6 fucking million. That is a hell of a lot of remnants of connected tissue, sinew, cartilage, and bone mass. Where is the evidence of the crime scene? Oh, of course, it's been covered up by the Jews, with the memorial stones scattered all across the supposed areas of pits. Of course, for ethical reasons. The Jewish-controlled BBC explained to us, no excavation was carried out and the ground is not disturbed, which would be a violation of Jewish law and tradition, banning the exhumation of the dead. Oh, how convenient. And how could the bodies be burned on soil, which is basically marshland, soaked boggy landscape? I'm not saying it would be impossible. If structures were built and engineered drainage carried out, but where is the evidence of these structures and accommodation for this perfect environment? There have been tentative scientific experiments on locations of these supposed death pits, but zero evidence has been produced for mass graves or mass body ash. Surprise, surprise. 17, logistics. The simple logistics of killing people in ovens or pretend shower rooms and huge fires is almost childlike in its imagination. Only a Jew could have the chutzpah to come up with such utter crap and expect the world to believe him it. Just pause. Stop for a minute and think about the practicality of murdering 6 million Jews by ovens or pretend shower rooms or fire pits. It's insane to go along with this narrative. This couldn't be done even today with modern technology and the time span this was supposed to have been done. Never mind in wartime when the Germans are fighting an intense war with limited resources. Just the time alone would be a factor, even if they did have facilities and fuel. What about the contamination of Zyklon B gas from the corpses to the SS officers when they went into the shower gas rooms? There is no mention of ventilation facilities to omit the gas prior to the officers entering the chambers and handling the corpses. Remembering, we are talking about a 24/7 schedule running nonstop for years, yet zero reported deaths of SS officers. Strange that. 18, absurdity. Drunken heads. That turned out to be a fabrication. Soap bars, that again were later verified as a mere conjecture. I always pondered why the Nazis would want to wash with Jew residue if they hated them so much. And of course, the classic lampshade. Yeah, the lampshade made from tattooed kike skin pervaded on display at The Hague and Nuremberg, later verified as animal skin. How about the sign at Dachau reading gas chamber, disguised as a shower room, never uses a gas chamber. Oh, if it wasn't so serious, and the swimming pool stating it was a water reservoir. And how about the Anne Frank fairy story written in biro pen when biros were extremely rare to come by before 1951, Anne Frank? And tell me, how could these survivors escape three death camps? What a fucking joke. And the story of Irene Zisplas swallowing defecating diamonds. Only a Jew could come up with a shitty narrative like that. Apparently the evil Nazis bashed Jew brains in with a pedal-driven brain-bashing machine while listening to the radio, then burned the bodies in 4 portable incinerators. This is laugh-out-loud humor. Pedal-driven. I guess they're a bicycle style, so they would have been getting some cardio while bashing brains in and listening to their favorite music. Sounds like an easy job. They also ground the bones of 200 bodies, 3¾ of a ton, at one time, as described in photographs and documents, which have conveniently disappeared. Studied bone grinding in special 10-day crash course seminars. Absurd, 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 to the point of being laughable. And this is what the whole world should be doing with this ridiculous fable. Laugh out loud at it. Ridicule it. Ridicule is our serious defense against this insult to common sense. 19, fat Jews. You've undoubtedly seen the images of the poor emaciated Jews again and again and again. And have you seen the images of the smiling fat Jews in the concentration camp? I'm being serious. Start digging. Start to unravel the truth about this historical fable and you will see another side to this. Take a look at the healthy Jews being released from Birkenau and Auschwitz in January 1945. These are images of happy campers, not oppressed victims of experimentation in death camps. 20, suddenly evil. If Hitler and his motley gang of evil Jew murderers were hell-bent on killing Jews, why did Hitler not round up all the Jews in this country? Why on earth did he leave the synagogues and Jewish communities? Why did he just round up the troublemakers and communists, who just happened to be 90% Jewish? The most puzzling thing to me about when hearing about Hitler's death camps and having visited Dachau is that I could never understand why the Germans, as a race and nation, allowed such atrocities, especially years later when I was in Germany and got to really know the Germans and observe firsthand how stoic and good-willed they all are. How? How could a civilized, intelligent, kind-hearted nation with such affinity to natural law allow such evil under their national interests? Why would they suddenly go off on a tangent for a few years and become mass-murdering monsters? I think many of us have been confused on that one. Well, they didn't, is the answer to that, because they and their leaders were certainly not evil. Quite the reverse. Hitler wasn't evil. SS officers were not evil. NSDAP was not evil. The common folk of Germany were not evil. And the whole nation as a whole held no evil philosophies. It's all a Jewish-created fabrication pushed out there by the saturation of Jewish-run Hollywood illusion and mass indoctrinations. Lies, lies, lies. It is our responsibility to stand up for the souls of these German heroes, for the present-day Germans who are to this day being decimated by Jewish perfidy. It is also our responsibility to stand up for the truth, for our Aryan folk and our future. This enormous lie on humanity must be crushed before we can begin to talk about our freedoms. Please do your bit to spread this truth. And that concludes Digger for Truth's article called Holocrap on Renegade Tribune. And that again is an excellent overview synopsis of reasons why the Holocaust, the Jewish Holocaust, is exactly that, a hoax. And so next I wanted to get into a little bit of a history about gas chambers and the construction, and a little bit of a, yeah, a little history on gas chambers. And this is from a book called, well, it's from the Holocaust Handbook series. I think they're up to 33 volumes now. I think it's the definitive set of books regarding Holocaust revision and examination of the whole event. And let's see, I think we're coming up to break here. All right, I'll catch you on the other side.
Hearing all about Jews and their beloved Israel. This is America.
Hey, don't say that. Jews do so much for us and deserve our thanks.
Okay, so what do they do?
Although they are only 2% of the population, they are running our banks and overall monetary system, ensuring our children receive proper education and medication, entertaining us with TV, movies, magazines, and gossip, running some of our biggest corporations, including the big tech giants, weeding out awful hate speech, and promoting the rainbow of alternative lifestyles and gender identities, and funding the campaigns of our honorable and honest politicians.
Wow, they sure do a lot.
That's right. Don't be an anti-Semite. Let the chosen rulers of this world know you appreciate them.
Thanks, Jews!
Yeah.
All right, welcome back to the roundtable. This is your host, Huddies. And this is not the roundtable, what am I saying? It's the wild card. Roundtable was a couple days ago. Sorry about that. This is the wild card. And I look like I have a lot more information to go over that I'm going to have time for, which is fine. I was thinking the other way. But, so we can continue on here. A little background history of crematoriums. And this is an article called The Crematoria Ovens of Auschwitz and Birkenau, and written by Carlo Mantogna, M-A-T-T-O-G-N-O. And he, I think, is likely the foremost Italian history revisionist. Written a number of books. I think he's probably put out a couple dozen books. Fairly prominent in the whole, or was, I don't know. I'm assuming he's still around. But, and this is one article in the book Dissecting the Holocaust, as I was saying, from the Holocaust Handbook series. This is volume number one, compiled by Guillermo Rudolph. But there's a number of articles by other authors in there as well. The book is like 500 pages, and this article alone, it's one of those articles where half the page is taken by footnotes. So I'm only going to read part of this article, but it goes on and the incredible detail. I mean, it's just like the research these guys have done is just, it's astounding, to say the least, I think. I mean, I guess if you do this for a living, you can do this kind of thing. And perhaps maybe you have training. I don't know if you get training in research, but I'm going to read some excerpts from this article. Find it again. Sorry, guys. It's 370. And so I'm going to continue here. Next article. Okay, introduction. This is by Carlos Mantogna. If a monstrous extermination of many hundreds of thousands of people took place in gas chambers in Auschwitz and Birkenau during the Second World War, and if the bodies of the victims were disposed of in the cremation facilities in those camps, then the, quote, murder weapon, the homicidal gas chamber, has an essential counterpart. The cremation oven. The eyewitnesses, quote, have tried to persuade us that the crematoria ovens of Auschwitz and Birkenau were satanic contraptions operating above and beyond the realm of physical laws, not ordinary cremation facilities subject to the same laws of chemistry, physics, and heat engineering as all other such installations. Historians have chosen to trust blindly in these witnesses, and in the process have led themselves to get carried away into making entirely erroneous claims. Modern-day cremation, the technology of crematoria ovens up to World War I. Cremation of dead bodies was practiced in Europe for more than 1,000 years before Homer's time. This custom was carried on until 785 AD when Charlemagne forbade it on pain of death in his decree of Paderborn, Paderborn. In the following centuries, cremation disappeared entirely from Christian Europe. The idea of cremation regained some popularity during the French Revolution, but it was during the second half of the 19th century before it gradually found general acceptance. The trend favoring cremation began to gain momentum in 1849, when the philologist Jacob Grimm gave a memorable lecture on the cremation of corpses at the Berlin Academy of Sciences. The idea was quickly taken up by eager pioneers and enthusiastically promoted. The first cremation in a crematorium oven in Europe took place on October 9th, 1874 in Dresden, in a makeshift oven designed by Friedrich Siemens. After a few cremations, this experimental procedure was banned by the Saxon government, but not for long. In those years, Italy was leading this modern movement for cremation, both legally and technologically. The first European crematorium was built in Milan in 1875, 1 year after cremation was recognized as a legal method for the disposal of the dead. The first German crematorium was put into operation in Gotha in December 10th, 1878, This period saw a great fervor of studies and experiments that led to the construction of several types of furnaces. Modern cremation had to satisfy certain ethical, aesthetic, and economic requirements, which were defined during a general conference on cremation technology held June 7, 1876 in Dresden. Many cremation facilities of the 1870s, were as yet very unreliable and costly to operate. Some had cremation times of up to 5 to 6 hours per corpse, so that some were torn down again after just a few cremations. But much better capacities and fuel efficiencies were quickly reached. The Guarini oven at Riolo, for instance, which started operation on September 6, 1877, needed only 220 to 330 pounds per corpse. The oven by Toisol and Fredat needed 100 kilograms in just 1 hour per corpse. In these ovens, the body was directly exposed to the flames, which were produced either by the incineration of the fuel or by combustion of the fuel gases from the gas generator. A principle devised by Frederick Siemens introduced the process of wholly indirect cremation using heated air, allowing only hot air but no flame gases to reach the body. This method predominated and unchallenged in Germany until 1924. In this new procedure, cremation was performed by means of air heated to 1,000 Celsius, 1,830 degrees Fahrenheit, in a regenerator or recuperator. The experimental prototype of such an oven was installed in 1878 in Goethe and was used for the cremation of animal carcasses only. Cremation took 135 minutes on average. The first cremation required 3,300 pounds of brown coal. Subsequent ones took 550 to 660 pounds or less, with the requirements decreasing step by step. The Swedish Klingenstierna oven was a distinct improvement over the Siemens oven. Besides a main firing, it had a secondary firing that served mostly to burn off the remaining gases and smoke particles. Combustion air was heated in a recuperator consisting of metal baffles, heat exchanger between the furnace gas and the combustion air. The body was introduced into the incineration chamber on a small cart that remained there for the entire duration of the cremation cycle. In Germany, this system was perfected by E. Dorivius and built by the firm of Gebruder Beck in Offenbach. The first models, which were installed in the crematory of Heidelberg, 1891, and Jena, 1898, still retained a cart for introduction of the body. But the 1899 model, Offenbach Crematorium, worked without a cart, and the incineration chamber was replaced by grating of refractory grills beneath two sloping surfaces angled like a funnel, channeled the ash into the ash pit. The metal type of recuperator was gradually replaced by one with refractory brick, and the oven took on the typical structure of the German crematory ovens with coke-fired gas generator. A prototype of the Schneider furnace was installed in the crematorium of Hamburg in 1892. Its structure was similar to that of the Klingensteiner Beck oven with some improvements to the gas generator. It took approximately 3 hours to get this oven to an operational temperature. The duration of a single cremation was between 45 and 90 minutes, with a coke consumption of 550 to 660 pounds for the first and 110 to 220 pounds for subsequent cremations. So the Rutman furnace had already the typical structure of a modern coke-fired crematorium oven. According to the experimental data taken at the crematorium of Stuttgart during 48 cremations between July 20th and September 15th, 1909, a cremation lasted in average 1 hour 33 minutes, with a minimum of 1 hour 10 minutes and a maximum of 2 hours 30 minutes. The oven designed by the Swedish firm Noss introduced some more improvements to the Klingensteiner Beck system. Its coke consumption for the heating and the first incineration was 300 kilograms and 50 to 90 kilograms for each subsequent cremation. In Germany, the company Gebruder Beck of Offenbach produced this oven under a license contract. Technological progress and developments in the inter-year wars. After the First World War, the peace dictate of Versailles forced Germany to give up coal-rich regions as well as to supply coal to the victorious powers. Hence, Germany saw herself forced to use the coal reserves left to her as efficiently as possible. For these reasons, German industry endeavored to redesign, in terms of heat engineering, all facilities consuming coal and coal products so as to maximize the return achieved per unit of fuel consumption. Crematory ovens and their operation were by no means exempt from this need for the thrifty use of coal. Consequently, a Prussian law dating from September 14, 1911 was amended in 1924. This law had permitted only the wholly indirect cremation of bodies for aesthetic reasons, but this process required more time and fuel than its alternative. The debate about this amendment was accompanied by, at times, heated arguments among the cremation experts, disputing which of the two methods was the more economic one. This question could be resolved only by means of scientific cremation experiments. The most significant experiments of this period were carried out in 1926 and 1927 in the crematorium of Dessau by the engineer Richard Kessler, who also wrote a detailed scientific report on the subject. In the following, we shall examine the results of these experiments. The construction method of the new ovens took into account the decisive factors involved in the optimum use of combustion heat that engineer Kessler had discovered in his experiments. As a result, the efficiency of the oven increased considerably. The most important technological innovations of that time include the reduction of the horizontal cross-section of the gas generator, more efficient recuperators, the installation of an afterburning grate, an air intake system to allow for more efficient afterburning, and the installation of appropriate measuring instruments. In the early 1930s, the coke-fired ovens with gas generator had reached the pinnacle of technological perfection. Yet at the same time, their inexorable decline began as they were being increasingly supplanted by significantly more economic heating systems, particularly ones using gas and electricity. From this point on, the existing coke-fired ovens were either torn down or restructured to accommodate gas heating. The new heating systems necessitated additional studies on the structure of the ovens as well as on the phenomena of cremation per se, and these studies were presented in significant technical publications. Even though the first German crematorium had already been built in 1878, cremation was not legally permitted until 1911, and it took until the 1930s before formal legislation on this matter actually appeared. The first real and complete cremation act was passed on March 15, 1934. Specific guidelines pertaining to the cremation ovens and the cremation processes soon followed thereafter. As the following table shows, the number of cremations in Germany rose astronomically between the time when the first crematorium was opened and the beginning of the Second World War. So the graph shows quite a substantial increase. 1878 to 1887, there's 50 per year, and then it rose 1889. Next 10 years, like 219 up to 1,238 to 8,800, 28,000 to between 1928 and 1937, there's 62,000, almost 63,000 cremations per year average in Germany. So cremation, I think, is a part of our heritage. I know my grandparents and my mother's side have been cremated. My folks are planning on getting cremated. A little more in this article. J.A. Topf and Soon Erfurt. Where crematorium ovens are concerned, the firm of J.A. Topf and Sons of Erfurt began manufacturing operations at the start of the First World War and was most notably successful in the early 1920s. Their early models pioneered several innovations, particularly a system of exterior muffle heating based on a patent by Max J. Kergel. This prevented the cremation products from entering the muffle, thus allowing for an entirely indirect cremation process. This cremation oven consisted of a coke generator, a self-contained cremation chamber or muffle, a system of baffles underneath, called the recuperators, which served to preheat the air required for the cremation, and the diversion of the carbon monoxide gases around the muffle. The ovens built during the 1920s needed 75 minutes, and consumed some 350 to 570 pounds of coke per cremation. During the 1920s, the firm of J. Topf & Sons became Germany's foremost commercial oven manufacturer. between 1922 and 1927, no less than 18 of the 24 ovens installed in the German crematoria were built by Topps. Excuse me. In the early 1930s, Topps' commercial supremacy was consolidated. By now, Topps and Sons had achieved a very advanced technological level. They deserve the credit for designing Germany's first fully functional gas heated cremation oven, 1927 in Dresden, as well as the country's first electric cremation oven, which came into service in Erfurt in 1933, just as Hitler was coming to power. The firm also pioneered improvements in cremation technology, such as the afterburning grate and the rotating grate. Even though electric top ovens had no competition in Germany, the company's supremacy in the oven manufacturing field was seriously threatened in those years by the newly developed gas oven of the Volkmann-Ludwig type. In technological respects, the top firm responded to the competition posed by the new oven by designing the model 1934 gas oven. In propagandistic terms, they responded with rather harsh polemics in the form of a most aggressive article by engineer Kurt Pufer, the man who designed the 3 and 8 muffled ovens of Birkenau. The criticism advanced in this article, however, was refuted by Richard Kessler. And I'll go on a little bit further with this, I think. This is at the point where it starts to get pretty dry and just details and whatnot. I mean, it's absolutely thoroughly researched, but I initially just wanted to go over kind of some history of, and this is all information I didn't know. I just came across this a few days ago. I found out I was going to do the wild card, started looking into this, and this is kind of interesting to me. Structure and operation of coke-fired cremation ovens of the 1930s. I'll read a little more of this, see how far I get. So the furnace consisted of a gas generator, an incineration room or muffle, post-combustion chamber below it, and a recuperator thereafter. The gas generator, lined with refractory material, had the usual grill for the coke and openings to regulate air intake and to remove ashes and cinders. A vertical or oblique channel conducted the combustion gases into the muffle. As a result of a lack of oxygen, the coke burnt only partly in the gas generator, producing carbon monoxide-rich gases, which are led into the muffle, where burnt with additional preheated air coming in from the recuperator. The muffle was a horizontal combustion chamber lined with refractory material. The German norms for the construction and operation of furnaces for the cremation of human corpses enacted in 1937 prescribed the following minimal measures for such a muffle: width 900 millimeters, height 900 millimeters, length 2500 millimeters. At the front, the muffle was closed with a guillotine-like shutter made of fireplay. In front of this shutter was an outer metal door. The bottom of the muffle consisted of a grill made of fireclay on which the coffin was placed. The remains of the body fell through the refractory grills into the post-combustion chamber with slanted walls, narrowing down to a small cavity in which the container for the ashes was placed. Openings in the post-combustion chamber led the combustion chambers into the recuperator, which is a heat exchanger consisting of intertwined countercurrent fresh air intake and exhaust gas exit channels. As a result of this heat exchange, the recuperator had temperatures between 400 and 600 Celsius. The oven was a two-level structure. Gas generator and recuperator were at a lower level, while the incineration chamber was at an upper level. The operation of the system was as follows. First, the shutter of the smoke flue was opened. Then the gas coke in the generator was lit with the help of some wood. As soon as the combustion gases burning in the muffle had increased the temperature to an operational level, the introduction shutter was opened and the coffin was introduced into the muffle. Because of the high temperature of the muffle, the coffin caught fire already during the introduction. It burned quickly, leaving the corpse on the grill. First, the corpse dehydrated, then the combustible parts incinerated. The solid incineration products of the corpse fell into the post-combustion chamber and ultimately into the ash chamber, while the gaseous products moved into the side flues of the recuperator and down through them into the waste gas flue, whence they rose up through the stack. When the flame development had stopped, the incandescent ashes were scraped from the ash container. The oven was operated with the help of various controls, such as fuel supply control, recuperator control, generator air intake control, and exhaust shutter control. And I think that's where I'm going to stop with this. He continues on, like I said. But I just want to give an overview of that. I thought that was really interesting. I hope you guys find it interesting. And kind of 10 minutes before break. So next on my list of things to talk about was I want to go over just a short list of history revisionists, historic revisionists. I have 13 listed here. And I think it's important to get these names out once in a while. These people have gotten arrested and hounded most of their lives. The Jews refused to leave them alone, trying to shut them up. And so I think giving their names a mention is a very good thing. Give them credit. So kind of an alphabetical order here. So the person I listed was Arthur Butz, doctor, born and raised in New York City. Received a bachelor in science, master in science, degrees in electrical engineering. 65, received his doctorate. He was a professor of electrical engineering and computer sciences. And he is most noted for writing the book The Hoax of the 20th Century, A Case Against the Presumed Extermination of European Jewry. And that was published, I think, in 1977, if I'm not mistaken. And it was one of the first things I came across when I was now going on almost 2 years now, when I became aware of the lies the Jews have created regarding World War II and the Holocaust and whatnot. And I saw it's still out there in PDF, this book. And I think it was a matter of days where I just read through. I just was obsessed. I couldn't believe the information in this. I just couldn't get enough of it. So Arthur R. Butz is still around, I believe. I don't think he's passed away yet. He's probably getting up there in age now. Listed as repercussions, vilified, and persecuted for almost 3 decades. And he's written quite a few articles and whatnot, and he is associated with Institute for Historical Review. And the next person I want to go over real quick is I'm not sure, T.S. Christopherson. And I'm assuming my internet's... I have everything else on PDF here except for this revisionist list. And if this ridiculous Wi-Fi isn't working, I guess I'm going to have to move on to the next thing. So we'll see what's going on here. Funny. I'm actually closer to the Wi-Fi unit than I would be where I normally am. Shucks, man. This is not... All right. Well, maybe I'll just go on to the next, next segment. Didn't seem to be wanting to... that's annoying. All right. So I can't reach. Yeah, man. I think. All right. I hope you guys are still hearing me. All right. All right. Yeah. I'd have to shut my computer off and reboot it in order to get to that. So. Okay. What I'm going to do is go into the next information I have set aside. So this is from a book. Well, it's not really a book. It was more like a pamphlet, like a large pamphlet. The one I have is like kind of large, just like 12, 13 by 11 or something. It's got a large pamphlet, maybe 20 pages. It was put out in 1974 initially by Richard Harwood, and it's titled "Did 6 Million Really Die?" And it's kind of influential. Arthur Butz was influenced by it to the point where he did write that book that I mentioned earlier, Hoax of the 20th Century, several years later. And it inspired a couple other people, such as the Frenchman Paul Racinier, to explore this hoax. So it was kind of a landmark in that respect. And I will start out with, I'm just going to do excerpts from this. It's probably in total, probably like 24 pages. And another publication that's, I don't see too many footnotes with this. It seems typical of a footnoted research document. But in this, what the copy I have in the PDF doesn't have the footnotes. So the first, they're kind of like little small segments. I'm going to read through it, get through a few before the break. This one's called Jews Called Emigration Extermination. It is very significant, however, that certain Jews are quick to interpret these policies of internal discrimination as equivalent to extermination itself. A 1936 anti-German propaganda book by Leon Buchtwanger and others entitled The Yellow Spot, The Extermination of 500,000 German Jews, Paris, 1936, presents a typical example. Despite its baselessness, in fact, the annihilation of the Jews is discussed in the first pages, straightforward emigration being regarded as the physical extermination of German Jewry. The Nazi concentration camps or political prisoners are also seen as potential instruments of genocide, and special reference is made to the 100 Jews still detained in Dachau in 1936, of whom 60 had been there since 1933. Further example was a sensational book by the German Jewish communist Hans Bimler called 4 Weeks in the Hands of Hitler's Hellhounds, the Nazi Murder Camp of Dachau, which was published in New York as early as 1933. Detained for his Marxist affiliations, he claimed that Dachau was a death camp, though by his own admission, he was released after only a month being there. The present regime in East Germany now issues a Hans Bimler Award for services to communism. And this article is from the early 70s. So. The fact that anti-Nazi genocide propaganda was being disseminated is possibly... And here we go. Great. I'll catch you on this side.
Is it really our greatest ally?
The USS Liberty?
The incessant spying?
The control of our politicians and police?
The attacks of September 11th?
The Zionist wars of aggression?
The blatant war crimes against innocent women and children?
The organ and human trafficking?
The safe haven for convicted child rapists?
Do we really need to keep going?
The time of Israeli influence over our country must come to an end.
AIPAC is where we will let them know we will not be their goyim slaves any longer. March 26th through the 28th, Washington, D.C.
Be there.
Hitting. Talk Radio.
Welcome back, everybody. This is the Wild Card Monday. My name's your host is Huddy, and I've been going over information regarding the Hall of Hoax, also known as the Holocaust. And I started reading this book. I got my internet back going on, so that's a good thing. And I guess I'll just continue on with this. I'll get back to the revisionist list later if I have time. And where I left off, detained the fact that the interviews for the detention of political opponents and subversives, principally liberals, social democrats, and communists of all kinds, of whom a portion were Jews, such as Hans Weimler. Unlike the millions enslaved in the Soviet Union, the German concentration camp population was always small. Reitinger, the Jew, admits that between 1934 and 1938, it seldom exceeded 20,000 throughout the whole of Germany, and the number of Jews was never more than 3,000. From his book from 1956, page 253. Zionist policy studied. The Nazi National Socialist view of Jewish emigration was not limited to a negative policy of simple expulsion, but was formulated along the lines of modern Zionism. The founder of political Zionism in the 19th century, Theodor Herzl, in his work The Jewish State, had originally conceived of Madagascar as a national homeland for the Jews, and this possibility was seriously studied by the National Socialists. It had been a main plank of the National Socialist Party platform for 1933 and was published by the party in its pamphlet form. This stated that the revival of Israel as a Jewish state was much less acceptable, since it would result in perpetual war and disruption in the Arab world, which has indeed been the case. The Germans were not originally proposing emigration to Madagascar. The Polish government had already considered the scheme in respect of their own Jewish population, and in 1937 they sent the Michael Lepecki expedition to Madagascar, accompanied by Jewish representatives to investigate the problems involved. They keep using the word Nazi in this article. It's like, I'm going to switch it to National Socialist. The first National Socialist proposals for a Madagascar solution were made in association with the Schacht Plan of 1938. On the advice of Goering, Hitler agreed to send the president of the Reichsbank, Dr. Hjalmar Schacht, to London for discussions with Jewish representatives Lord Bearstedt and Mr. Rubley of New York. The plan was that German Jewish assets would be frozen as security for an international loan to finance Jewish emigration to Palestine. And Schacht reported on these negotiations to Hitler at Berchtesgaden on January 2, 1939. The plan, which failed due to British refusal to accept the financial terms, was first put forward on November 12, 1938, at a conference convened by Goering, who revealed that Hitler was already considering the emigration of Jews to a settlement in Madagascar. Later in December, Ribbentrop was told by M. Georges Monet, the French Foreign Secretary, that the French government itself was planning the evacuation of 10,000 Jews to Madagascar. Prior to the Schacht-Palestinian proposals of 1938, which were essentially a protraction of discussions that had begun as early as 1935, Numerous attempts had been made to secure Jewish emigration to other European nations, and these efforts culminated in the Avignon Conference of July 1938. However, by 1939, the scheme of Jewish emigration to Madagascar had gained the most favor in German circles. It is true that in London, Helmuth Wolfhut of the German Foreign Office discussed limited Jewish emigration to Rhodesia and British Guiana as late as April 1939. But by January 24th, when Goering wrote to Interior Minister Frick ordering the creation of a central emigration office for Jews and commissioned Heydrich of the Reich Security Head Office to solve the Jewish problem by means, quote, of emigration evacuation, unquote, the Madagascar plan was being studied in earnest. By 1939, the consistent efforts of the German government to secure the departure of Jews from the Reich had resulted in the emigration of 400,000 German Jews from a total population of about 600,000 and an additional 480,000 emigrants from Austria and Czechoslovakia, which constituted almost their entire Jewish population. This was also accomplished through offices of Jewish emigration in Berlin, Vienna, and Prague established by Adolf Eichmann, the head of the Jewish Investigation Office of the Gestapo. So eager were the Germans to secure this emigration that Eichmann even established a training center in Austria where young Jews could learn farming in anticipation of being smuggled illegally to Palestine. Had Hitler cherished any intention of exterminating the Jews, it is inconceivable that he would have allowed more than 800,000 to leave the Reich territory with the bulk of their wealth, much less considered plans to a mass emigration in Palestine or Madagascar. What is more, we shall see that the policy of emigration from Europe was still under consideration well into the war period, notably the Madagascar Plan, which Eichmann discussed in 1940 with French colonial experts after the defeat of France had made the surrender of a colony a practical proposition. Into that little section. I was reading this earlier today. I imagined for a moment what it would be like to have all the Jews leave. It's like they must have been ecstatic. And so the next thing I wanted to read was the war. Okay, German policy toward the Jews after the outbreak of the war. With the coming of the war, the situation regarding the Jews altered drastically. It is not widely known that World Jewry declared itself to be a belligerent party in the Second World War. There was, therefore, ample basis under international law for the Germans to intern the Jewish population as a hostile force. On September 5, 1939, Chaim Weizmann, the principal Zionist leader, had declared war against Germany on behalf of the world's Jews, stating that the Jews stand by Great Britain and will fight on the side of the democracies. The Jewish agency is ready to enter into immediate arrangements for utilizing Jewish manpower, technical ability, resources, etc. That's kind of interesting. They claimed they declared war in Germany two times, once in 1933 and second time September 5th, 1939 by Chaim Weizmann. Next section, detention of enemy aliens. All Jews had thus been declared agents willing to prosecute a war against the German Reich, and as a consequence, Himmler and Heydrich were eventually to begin the policy of internment. It is worth noting that the United States and Canada had already interned all Japanese aliens and citizens of Japanese descent in detention camps before the Germans applied the same security measures against the Jews of Europe. Moreover, there had been no such evidence or declaration of disloyalty by these Japanese Americans as had been given by Weizmann. The British, too, during the Boer War, interned all the women and children of the population, and thousands had died as a result. Yet in no sense could the British be charged with wanting to exterminate the Boers. The detention of Jews in the occupied territories of Europe served two essential purposes from the German viewpoint. The first was to prevent unrest and subversion. Himmler had informed Mussolini on October 11, 1942, that German policy toward the Jews had altered during World Wartime entirely for reasons of military security. He complained that thousands of Jews in the occupied regions were conducting partisan warfare, sabotage, and espionage, a view confirmed by official Soviet information given to Raymond Arthur Davis that no less than 35,000 European Jews are waging partisan war under Tito in Yugoslavia. As a result, the Jews were to be transported to restricted areas and detention camps both in Germany, especially after March 1942, in the government general of Poland. As the war proceeded, the policy developed of using Jewish detainees for labor in the war effort. The question of labor is fundamental when considering the alleged plans of genocide against the Jews, for on grounds of logic alone, the latter would entail the most senseless waste of manpower, time, and energy while prosecuting a war of survival on two fronts. Certainly, after the attack on Russia, the idea of compulsory labor had been taken precedence over German plans for Jewish emigration. The protocol of a conversation between Hitler and the Hungarian regent, Horthy, on April 17, 1943, reveals that the German leader personally requested Horthy to release 100,000 Hungarian Jews for work in the pursuit plan program of the Luftwaffe at a time when the aerial bombardment of Germany was increasing. This took place at a time when, supposedly, the Germans were already seeking to exterminate the Jews, but Hitler's request clearly demonstrates the priority aim of expanding his labor force. In harmony with this program, concentration camps became, in fact, industrial camps. At every camp where Jews and other nationalities were detained, there were large industrial plants and factories supplying material for the German war effort. The Buna rubber factory at Bergen-Belsen, for example, Buna and IG Farben industry at Auschwitz, and the electrical firm of Siemens at Ravensbrück. In many cases, special concentration camp money notes were issued as payment for labor, enabling prisoners to buy extra rations from camp shops. The Germans were determined to obtain the maximum economic return from the concentration camp system, an object wholly at variance with any plan to exterminate millions of people in them. It was a function of the SS Economy and Administration Office, headed by Oswald Pohl, to see that the concentration camps became major industrial producers. So as we see, the evidence is just absolutely overwhelming when you just, and all I'm doing is scratching the surface. And suddenly, a plethora of information arises, completely and utterly denouncing the kosher narrative, just crushing it to smithereens. Got some people walking by here. So I'm going to go on here to read a little bit more about this in this article. This little section is entitled Auschwitz and Polish Jewry. Concentration camp at Auschwitz near Krakow in Poland has remained at the center of the alleged extermination of millions of Jews. Later we will see how, when it was discovered by honest observers in the British and American zones after war that no gas chambers existed in German camps such as Dachau and Bergen-Belsen, attention was shifted to the eastern camps, particularly Auschwitz. Ovens definitely existed here, it was claimed, and there were. Unfortunately, the eastern camps were in the Russian zone of occupation, so that no one could verify whether these allegations were true or not. The Russians refused to allow anyone to see Auschwitz until about 10 years after the war, by which time they were able to alter its appearance and give some plausibility to the claim that millions of people had been exterminated there. If anyone doubts that the Russians are capable of such deception, they should remember the monuments erected at sites where thousands of people were murdered in Russia by Stalin's secret police. But where the monuments proclaimed them to be victims of German troops in World War II. The truth about Auschwitz is that it was the largest and most important industrial concentration camp, producing all kinds of material for the war industry. The camp consisted of synthetic coal and rubber plants built by IG Farben Industries, for whom the prisoners supplied labor. Auschwitz also comprised an agricultural research station with laboratories, plant nurseries, and facilities for stock breeding, as well as Krupp's armament works. We have already remarked that this kind of activity was a prime function of the camps. All major firms had subsidiaries in them, and the SS even opened their own factories. Accounts of visits by Himmler to the camps show that his main purpose was to inspect and assess their industrial efficiency. When he visited Auschwitz in March 1941, accompanied by high executives of IG Farben, he showed no interest in the problems of the camp as a facility for prisoners, but merely ordered that the camp be enlarged to take 100,000 detainees to supply labor for IG Farben. This hardly accords with the policy of exterminating prisoners by the million. Yeah, fuck you, Jews. Let's see, so to this. I want to get to this part about the Red Cross. I'm going to skip to that. There's just a couple paragraphs on that. So yeah, this next section is going to be about the Red Cross assessment, which obviously the Jews overlook because they're, I think, living in a different reality. So this section is called "The Jews in the Concentration Camps: A Factual Appraisal by the Red Cross." There's one survey of the Jewish question in Europe during World War II and the conditions of Germany's concentration camps, which is almost unique in its honesty and objectivity. The three-volume, quote, report of the International Committee of the Red Cross on its activities during the Second World War, Geneva, 1948. This comprehensive account from an entirely neutral source incorporated and expanded the findings of two previous works from 1946 and 1947. The team of authors, headed by Frederick Sordier, explained in the opening pages of the report that their object in the tradition of the Red Cross had been strict political neutrality, and herein lies its great value. The ICRC successfully applied the 1929 Geneva Military Convention in order to gain access to civilian internees held in Central and Western Europe by the German authorities. By contrast, the ICRC was unable to gain any access to the Soviet Union, which had failed to ratify the convention. The millions of civilian and military internees held in the USSR, whose conditions were known to be far worse, were completely cut off from any international contact or supervision. The Red Cross report is of value in that it first clarifies the legitimate circumstances under which Jews were detained in concentration camps, i.e. as enemy aliens. In describing the two categories of civilian internees, the report distinguishes the second type as civilians deported on administrative grounds who are arrested for political or racial motives because their presence was considered a danger to the state or the occupation forces. These persons, it continues, were placed on the same footing as persons arrested or imprisoned under common law for security reasons. The report admits that the Germans were at first reluctant to permit supervision by the Red Cross of people detained on grounds relating to security. But by the latter part of 1942, the ICRC obtained important concessions from Germany. They were permitted to distribute food parcels to major concentration camps in Germany from August 1942. And from, quote, February 1943 onwards, this concession was extended to all camps and prisons, unquote. The ICRC soon established contact with camp commandants and launched a food relief program which continued to function until the last month of 1945, letters of thanks for which came pouring in from Jewish internees. Red Cross recipients were Jews. Next section. The report states that, quote, as many as 9,000 parcels were packed daily. From the autumn of 1943 until May 1945, about 1,112,000 parcels with a total weight of 4,500 tons was sent off to the concentration camps. In addition to food, these contained clothing and pharmaceutical supplies. Quote, parcels were sent to Dachau, Buchenwald, Sangerhausen, Sachsenhausen, Orenburg, Flossenbürg, Landesbergen, Lech, Luha, Ravensbrück, near Vienna, and in two camps near Vienna and in central and southern Germany. The principal recipients were Belgians, Dutch, French, Greeks, Italians, Norwegians, Poles, and stateless Jews. In the course of the war, the, quote, the committee was in a position to transfer and distribute in the form of relief supplies over 20 million Swiss francs collected by Jewish welfare organizations throughout the world, in particular by the American Joint Distribution Committee of New York, unquote. This latter organization was permitted by the German government to maintain offices in Berlin until the American entry into the war. The ICRC complained that obstruction of their vast relief operation for Jewish internees came not from Germans, but from the tight Allied blockade of Europe. Most of their purchases of relief food were made in Romania, Hungary, and Slovakia. The ICRC had special praise for the liberal conditions which prevailed at Theresienstadt up to the time of their last visit there in April 1945. This camp, quote, where there were about 40,000 Jews deported from various countries, was a relatively privileged ghetto, unquote. According to the report, the committee's delegates were able to visit the camp at Theresienstadt, which was used exclusively for Jews and was governed by special conditions. For information gathered by the committee, this camp had been started as an experiment by certain leaders of the Reich. These men wished to give the Jews the means of setting up a communal life in a town under their own administration, possessing almost complete autonomy. Two delegates were able to visit the camp on April 6, 1945. They confirmed the favorable impression gained on the first visit, unquote. The ICRC also had praise for the regime of Ion Antonescu of fascist Romania, where the committee was able to extend relief, special relief, to 183 Romanian Jews until the time of the Soviet occupation. The aid then ceased, and the ICRC complained bitterly that it never succeeded in, quote, in sending anything whatsoever to Russia, unquote. The same situation applied to many German camps after their liberation by the Russians. The ICRC received a voluminous flow of mail from Auschwitz until the period of the Soviet occupation, when many of the internees were evacuated westward. But the efforts of the Red Cross to send relief to internees remaining at Auschwitz under Soviet control was futile. However, food parcels continued to be sent to former Auschwitz inmates transferred west to such camps as Buchenwald and Oranienburg. And just a side note, I know I read a little bit of other losses, and I know Eisenhower or somebody along the line, the Red Cross were shipped. They had a trainload of food going to the Eisenhower camps in the Rhine area. I don't know how many cars, and it went all the way from Switzerland to that area, and they were told to turn around, and they brought their food back to the Red Cross, because then Eisenhower wanted to starve all the noble German warriors. Next section, no evidence of genocide. One of the most important aspects of the Red Cross report is that it clarifies the true cause of those deaths that undoubtedly occurred in the camps towards the end of the war. Says the report, quote, in the chaotic condition of Germany after the invasion during the final months of the war, the camps received no food supplies at all, and starvation claimed an increasing number of victims. Itself alarmed by the situation, the German government last informed the ICRC on February 1, 1945. In March 1945, discussions between the president of the ICRC and general of the SS Kaltenbrunner gave even more decisive results. Relief could henceforth be distributed by the ICRC, and one delegate was authorized to stay in each camp. Clearly, the German authorities were at pains to relieve the dire situation as far as they were able. The Red Cross are quite explicit in stating that food supplies ceased at this time due to the Allied bombing of German transportation. And in the interest of interned Jews, they had protested on March 15, 1944, against the barbarous aerial warfare of the Allies. By October 2, 1944, the Red Cross warned the German Foreign Office of the impending collapse of the German transportation system, declaring that starvation conditions for people throughout Germany were becoming inevitable. In dealing with this comprehensive three-volume report, it is important to stress that the delegates of the International Red Cross found no evidence whatever at the camps in Axis-occupied Europe of a deliberate policy to exterminate the Jews. In all its 1,600 pages, the report does not even mention such a thing as a gas chamber. It admits that Jews, like all other wartime nationalities, suffered rigors and privations. But its complete silence on the subject of planned extermination is ample refutation of the 6 million holo-hoax legend. Like the Vatican representatives with whom they worked, the Red Cross found itself unable to indulge in the irresponsible charges of genocide, which had become the order of the day. So far as the genuine mortality rate is concerned, the report points out that most of the Jewish doctors from the camps were being used to combat typhus on the Eastern Front, so that they were unavailable when the typhus epidemics of 1945 broke out in the camps. Incidentally, it's frequently claimed that mass executions were carried out in gas chambers cunningly disguised as shower facilities. Again, the report makes nonsense of this allegation. Quote, not only the washing places, but the installations for baths, showers, and laundry were inspected by the delegates. They had often to take action to have fixtures made less primitive and to get them repaired or enlarged, unquote. And let's see, was that anyone section here. So very interesting. Even going by just simply the Red Cross report, which is an objective, honest assessment, the Jewish Holocaust is debunked. It turns into just a piece of pile of dog shit somewhere on the road or something. In the last section, not all were in tune. Volume 3 of the Red Cross Report, Chapter 3, Jewish Civilian Population, deals with the, quote, aid given to the Jewish section of the free population, unquote. And this chapter makes it quite plain that by no means all of the European Jews were placed in internment camps, but remained subject to certain restrictions as part of the free civilian population. This conflicts directly with the, quote, thoroughness of the supposed extermination program, and with the claim in the forged Hess memoirs that Eichmann was obsessed with seizing every single Jew could lay his hands on. In Slovakia, for example, where Eichmann's assistant Dieter Weislaseni was in charge, the report states a large proportion of the Jewish minority had permission to stay in the country, and at certain periods Slovakia was looked upon as a comparative haven of refuge for Jews, especially for those coming from Poland. Those who remained in Slovakia seemed to have been in comparative safety until the end of 1944, when a rising against the German forces took place. While it is true that the law of May 15, 1942 had brought about the internment of several thousand Jews, these people were held in camps where the conditions of food and lodging were tolerable, and where the internees were allowed to do paid work on terms almost equal to those of the free labor market. Not only did large numbers of the 3 million or so European Jews avoid internment altogether, but the emigration of Jews continued throughout the war, generally by way of Hungary, Romania, and Turkey. Ironically, post-war German emigration from German-occupied territories was also facilitated by the Reich, as in the case of the Polish Jews who had escaped France before its occupation. The Jews from Poland, who, whilst in France, had obtained permits enough. And it sounds like coming in a break. Ian Shirley.
Douglas Rushkoff on why Jews are dangerous.
The thing that makes Judaism dangerous to everybody, to every race, to every nation, to every idea, is that we smash things that aren't true. We don't believe in the boundaries of nation state. We don't believe in the ideas of these individual gods that protect individual groups of people. These are all artificial constructions, and Judaism really teaches us how to see that. In a sense, our detractors have us right in that we are a corrosive force. We're breaking down the false gods of all nations and all people because they're not real. And that's very upsetting to people.
Krás á köldu svelli.
And welcome back to the Wild Card. I'm your host, Huddy, tonight, and I'm going over information about the Holocaust, the Holo hoax, the big lie. And I just want to finish up this one little section here. It's just a couple more, it's literally like 5 or 6 more sentences, I guess. More than that. Anyways, onward. So, So Jews did not have it so bad. They got to go to Slovakia. They were hanging out there. They were getting fed. They were getting how many 4.5 tons of parcels in the course of a year or two, food and clothing. I mean. And then you have all the German people getting just hellbombed. I mean, it's like, yeah, quite the contrast. And then you get these Jews crying for years, these fucking pathetic Jews. Oh my God. So, maybe I'll just go on to the next thing. I think I'll just skip in the next one. It's kind of interesting. This is a book called, and it's another book in the Holocaust handbook series. It's number 3. It's kind of a shorter book, written by Jürgen Graf. And it's called The Giant with Feet of Clay. And it is a rebuttal to a book that was published in 1961, which is considered kind of the book based on the decimation of the Jew in World War II. And I'll start reading here. In the last few decades, a vast literature on the Holocaust has appeared, but there's a general agreement that there's one work which can be regarded as the standard work in the subject. Raoul Hilberg's The Destruction of the European Jews. Born in Vienna in 1926, the Jew Hilberg emigrated to the United States with his parents in 1939. 1944, he joined the American Army. In 1948, he began to study the question of the destiny of Jews under the National Socialist regime. In the years 1951-52, he worked in the Federal Documentation Center at Alexandria, Virginia, where, get this, his job was to evaluate captured German documents. I read that the other day and just, I got disgusted with that. Like, these slimy fucking Jews, like, rifling through all these German documents and just like you just have absolutely no right to go even think about it for that matter. It's just, I mean, that's just the tip of the iceberg. Of course, they just they rifled through everything in Germany after World War II. And he got a doctorate degree in 1955. And Destruction of European Jews first appeared in 1961. Was unprinted, unchanged, 1967, 1975, and 1985. A revised and definitive edition with a few changes followed. Amazing, the voluminous work was not published in German until 1982, and then only a small publisher. And this book uses the 3-volume edition published in May 1977. Hilberg's study on the, quote, Holocaust claims to be the unrivaled, best, and most exhaustive work of its kind. And this book goes on to absolutely just decimate his work and show it for what it really is, which is a big deceptive lie, which is how the Jews live their lives. So I will start, read a couple things from here. Okay, here's like 3 general kind of themes that are going to kind of like start to tear down his work. General remarks. 3 points are noteworthy on first reading of Hilberg's work. 1, consistent ignoring of opposing theses. Whoever undertook to read Hilberg's standard work without further knowledge of the problem in the study of the Holocaust would never suspect that the version of events offered there is in dispute. Hilberg does not utter the least suggestion that there is a school of researchers who dispute not only the existence of a policy of extermination of the Jews in the Third Reich, but also the existence of extermination camps and homicidal gas chambers. Other advocates of the Orthodox version of the Holocaust at least mention the existence of such deviant ideas, usually only to malign them without studying them. Hilberg, however, pretends he has never heard of anything of the religionists. He pretends he has never heard of the studies of such respected and serious scholars as Arthur Butz, Wilhelm Stoglich, or Robert Frierson. Hilberg does not make mention of a single revisionist book or single revisionist journal, and he does not even peripherally discuss any revisionist objection to the annihilation thesis. When Hilberg published the first edition of The Destruction of the European Jews in 1961, he could perhaps have justified ignoring viewpoints which threw doubt on the accepted version of the fates of Jews in the Third Reich. The few revisionist works of the time were fairly modest. In 1985, such a position was no longer tenable. It is worth noting that revisionist research has made great progress since that year, while the proponents of the extermination thesis have been marching in place, and with the sole exception of Jean-Claude Pressac, have nothing new to offer. Of course they don't. Because ignoring or suppressing counterarguments is a telltale sign of unscholarly method, considerable doubt must be cast on the credibility of Hilberg's scholarship. Suppressing counterarguments. So in order to argue something, you need to know the argument. 2. No photos, no descriptions of the homicidal gas chambers and gas vans. Hilberg's gigantic three-volume work, running to 1,351 pages, contains exactly 3 photographs, namely those in the title pages of the 3 volumes. In the text itself, Destruction of the European Jews, therefore, will be called DEJ. In the text itself, there's not one photograph, which must be considered unusual for such extensive work. Likewise, he offers his reader no description of a gas chamber or a gas van. Although this seems important in view of the novelty and the monstrousness of the use of such killing machines, there's no illustration or sketch which might give inquisitive readers insight into how these gruesome instruments of murder allegedly functioned. Hilberg's aversion to encounter the physical reality of the concentration camps and the so-called extermination camps can also be seen in the fact that he has never personally undertaken an investigation at the location of the camps. Before 1985, this man had begun his studies on the Holocaust back in 1948, had spent exactly one day in Treblinka and another half day in Auschwitz, one in Auschwitz-Birkenau. In all 3 cases, this was only to participate in memorial ceremonies. He has never visited any other concentration camps at any time. This has a very odd appearance. In contrast to Hilberg, revisionists such as Zbigniew Federer, Robert Frierson, Carlo Mantegna, Guillermo Rudolph, and the writer of these lines, and also the non-revisionist Jean-Claude Pressac, have made thorough examinations of the buildings where the witnesses say the mass murders took place and have studied the applicable construction drawings. Such on-site research is absolutely necessary for solving this controversy. So the stupid Jew never went to the place. 3. Discrepancy between the title and the contents of the work. There's no doubt that the larger part of the material Hilberg presents rests on reliable sources. This applies particularly to the 400 pages in which he describes the persecution of the Jews, the anti-Jewish laws and measures taken by Germany and her allies. However, the work is not entitled The Persecution of the European Jews, but The Destruction of the European Jews. His title is not suitable for the work taken as a whole. Someone who has struggled through the 283 pages of the first volume has not yet encountered the subject for which Hilberg has named his work. The first 123 pages of the second volume, namely pages 287 to 410, are devoted to the mobile killing operations. This concerns the mass killings behind the Eastern Front. No fewer than 515 pages deal with the deportations of the Jews from areas controlled by Germany or her allies. With respect to the deportations, the facts are largely undisputed. That which makes the Holocaust so spectacular and bestial in the popular imagination, namely the industrialized slaughter and extermination camps, first shows its face on page 927. This is the beginning of the chapter on killing center operations. Yet the reader must persevere for yet another 100 pages until the subject finally comes around to killing operations. In the previous five subchapters, origins, organization, personal maintenance, labor utilization, medical experiments, and finally confiscations in the annihilation centers were discussed. Remarkably, the subchapter killing operations is only 19 pages long. The subject has already moved on to liquidation of the killing centers and the end of the destruction process. The third volume of 290 pages is devoted entirely to consequences, reflections, after effects, and further developments before the appendix closes the work. The latter contains Hilberg's data on Jewish population's loss. So I summarize. 123 pages of the 1,351-page standard work on the Holocaust deal with the killings behind the Eastern Front, which has received less attention both in the scholarly and in the popular literature, and which, if we can go by Hilberg's victim accounts, are also numerically less significant than the claimed mass killings in extermination camps. A total of 19 pages out of 1,351 pages are devoted to the central picture of the Holocaust, the practical course of the claimed mass killings in gas chambers. Plus, there are 11 more pages on the related question of the liquidation of the killing centers. And finally, the entire first and greater part of the second volume, in particular the 515 pages of deportations, most of the first volume and all the second volume containing 470 pages on deportations, have no direct bearing on the subject for which Hilberg has named his work, namely the destruction of the European Jews. In the third volume, only the population statistics are applicable to our subject. Already at this point, it can be seen that the Hilberg work does not contain what the title promises. Of course, this makes the work of the critic easier in that it permits him to concentrate on a relatively small part of this large work and dispense the rest with a few comments. And that is a brief overview and rebuttal to the deceptive lies that the book is and creates. And continue on a few more sections of this book. Okay, so once again, this is another book that's heavily footnoted. I mean, it's like, you know, it's got footnotes coming out of its ears. It's a piece of researched evidence is what it is. Nothing less than that. As opposed to Raoul Hilberg's fantasy. The killing centers. The initial situation. From page 927 forward, we confront the main theme of the Holocaust, namely the supposed mass killings, killing of Jews in killing centers, specially constructed for that purpose, which Hilberg characterizes as the following. The most striking fact about the killing center operations is that, unlike the earlier phases of the destruction process, they were unprecedented. Never before in history had people been killed on an assembly line basis. Ooh. Foul. 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 Foul, Hilberg. In this chapter, the central problem that has caused Hilberg so much trouble from the beginning of its second volume, namely the complete lack of documentary evidence for the presence of such centers, assumes gigantic proportions. Every, quote, assembly line in the world can be drawn, blueprinted, photographed, except, it seems, Hilberg's. We're just supposed to believe you, Raoul Hilberg. No documentary paperwork has survived from the four pure extermination camps. Chelmo, Belzec, Sobibor, Treblinka. The Orthodox historians explain that this is because the Germans destroyed it in time. This certainly cannot be excluded, but then why did the Germans carelessly leave behind stacks of records in Auschwitz and Majdanek? Court historians of the Allies never consider a second possibility, namely that the Soviets and the Polish communists captured German records in the four other extermination camps, as well as in Auschwitz and Majdanek, but got rid of them or let them disappear into secret archives because they, too, would blatantly contradict the desired propagandistic view of these camps. For Belzec, Hilberg mentions journals of Fritz Reuter, the deputy director of the Population of Welfare Subdivision of the Interior Division of the Office of the Governor of Lublin. According to these journals, Hans Hoffler, an assistant of Odilo Globenczyk, stated a camp for Jews was to be built in Belzec on the eastern border of the general government. Since no wartime German documents have survived from these three camps or from Chelmno, and there are no material remains except for some barracks foundations in Chelmno, Hilbert is free to babble as much as he wants, supported by a few witness reports and also Adelbert Ruckerl's frequently referenced book, something, which itself is almost exclusively based on witness testimonials given in federal German trials. Hilbert is less free to do so in the case of Auschwitz and Majdanek. But one thing the structures identified as killing gas chambers have partly survived, so one can examine them with respect to their suitability for the use ascribed to them. For another thing, in this case, we are in possession of a large number of wartime records, and these do not contain any indication of a policy of annihilation or of killing chambers, but do contain much evidence for the economic significance of these camps, growl Hilberg, you fucking liar. And I think I might stop at that. Goes on and oh, one more thing. Yeah, in this book, that's right. It's a short little piece at the end. It's kind of hilarious in a way. Because this fucker Raoul Hilberg got called to the stand at Zindel's first trial. And, of course, he made a complete ass of himself. But here's a little description of what went on. Let's see what kind of time we got. 15 minutes left. Hilbert's debacle at the first Zindel trial. In Toronto in 1985, a trial took place against the German-Canadian Ernst Zindel. At the instigation of a Holocaust Remembrance Association, he had been accused of breaking a law against spreading false news, which was later declared by Canada's Supreme Court to be unconstitutional because he had distributed Robert Harwood's pamphlet, 6 Million Really Die, which is what I went through a little while ago, right from that. Which is pretty good if somebody wants to have a general synopsis of the information countering the Holocaust lie. Good thing to have. Trial ended with Zindel sentenced to 15 months prison term. The sentence was reaffirmed by trial on appeal in 1988, but the term of imprisonment was reduced to 9 months, and on August 27, 1992, the Supreme Court threw out the conviction. Raoul Hilberg had been called in the first trial as a witness for the prosecution. Mercilessly pressed by Zindel's combative attorney, Douglas Christie, to whom Robert Ferrison, present in the courtroom, frequently passed notes with pertinent questions. The giant of the standard work in the Holocaust met his Waterloo. He rejected an invitation to testify at the trial on appeal 3 years later, but prosecutor Peter Griffiths requested that a statement given in the initial trial 3 years before be read again in court. In her excellent narrative, Did 6 Million Die, bearing the same title as the Harwood pamphlet that led to the trial, Barbara Kulaska had partially summarized Hilbert's statements and partially quoted them directly from the transcript of the trial. Christie asked Hilbert about the Hitler order for the extermination of all Jews, which had appeared in his first edition. And ironically, the second edition was then in preparation. After endless excuses, Hilbert finally conceded that there was no proof for such an order. Later, the following exchange occurred between Christie and Hilbert. What do you mean by scientific report? Asked Hilbert. I don't usually have to define simple words, said Christie, but by scientific report, I mean a report conducted by anyone who purported to be a scientist and who examined physical evidence. Name one report of such a kind that showed the existence of gas chambers anywhere in Nazi-occupied territory. I still don't quite understand the import of your question, said Hilbert. Are you referring to a German or a post-war, I don't care. German, post-war, Allied, Soviet, any source at all. Name one, said Christie, you fucking asshole. To prove what, asked Hilbert. To conclude that they have physically seen a gas chamber. One scientific report, repeated Christie. Just one. I'm really at a loss. I'm very seldom at a loss, but, Judge Locke interrupted. Dr. G. Do you know of such a report? No, replied Hilberg. Little shrimp. With respect to Kurt Gerstein, who is quoted as a source in his book a number of times, Christie asked Hilberg whether he would not normally consider someone to be crazy or a liar who maintained that one could stuff between 28 and 32 persons per square meter in a room 1.3 meters high. Well, on this particular datum, I would be very careful, said Hilberg, because Gerstein, apparently, was a very excitable person. He was capable of all kinds of statements. Christie produced the Gerstein statement and proceeded to ask Hilberg whether certain statements appeared in the statement. Hilberg agreed that in his statement, Gerstein alleged that 700 to 800 persons were crushed together in 25 square meters and 45 cubic meters. He also agreed that he had ignored this part of Gerstein's statement in his book. And he refers to Hitler and Himmler. And he refers to Hitler and Himmler witnessing gassings, right? Asked Christie. Hilberg agreed that Gerstein had made the statement that I was absolutely and totally false. Hilberg agreed that Gerstein. Christie asked Hilberg whether he considered Gerstein's statement that at Belzec and Treblinka nobody bothered to make a count, and that in fact about 25 million people, not only Jews, directly killed, was credible? Well, parts of it are true, and other parts of it are sheer exaggeration, manifest and obvious exaggeration. To me, the important point made in this statement is that there were no counting at this point at which people entered the gas chamber, said Hilberg. So you take the obviously exaggerated part and use the part that you thought was credible, that there was no counting, right, said Christie? Yes. Oh, Hilberg, the researcher. He's the master researcher. Hilberg had to admit that all the, quote, proofs for mass murder in the Eastern camps stem from Stalinist Soviet sources. The whole site, suggested Christie, was within the Soviet sphere of control, and nobody from the West was allowed into those camps to investigate. Isn't that right? Well, I don't know of any requests made to investigate. When you say no one was allowed, it implies some requests, said Hilberg. All I can say is I know of no Western investigators early on in Auschwitz or any of Treblinka, asked Christie. Well, there's no more Treblinka in 1945. Sobibor? That was no more. Majdanek? Majdanek is another matter. Was there anybody from the West that went to Majdanek, asked Christie? Not to my knowledge. Belzec? Belzec was the first camp to have been obliterated. Chelmor or Stutthof? No, sir. Auschwitz or Birkenau? No. Concerning Rudolf Hoss, Hilberg's star witness for the mass murder Auschwitz, whom he cites many times, Christie asked why he had mentioned a non-existent camp. Yes, I've seen that garbled reference, said Hilberg. It may have been Belzec. It's very hard if the man did not write anything. If he said things, if he was tired, if he was misunderstood, if he misspoke himself. Christie pointed out that Haas referred to Belzec as well as Woldseck. I suggest to you, he said to Hilberg, that there is a reason to believe that this man was not only being obliged to sign a confession in a language he didn't understand, but things were being put into a statement for him that were patently absurd, like Gerstein. There was obvious confusion in that one statement, said Hilberg. Christie produced Nuremberg document 3865-PS, the Hoff affidavit. Hilberg agreed he had seen the document before and agreed he had seen the Woldseck reference. Yes, I've seen that reference. It's terrible. It's obvious that something wasn't quite right about that individual. Wouldn't you agree, asked Christie? No, I wouldn't say that something wasn't quite right about the individual, said Hilberg. I would say that something wasn't quite right about the circumstances under which this was made as an affidavit. With the circumstances about something wasn't quite right, Hilberg undoubtedly meant the 3 days of torture which the confession was run of Rudolf Hoss, whom he quotes 26 times as star witness for the annihilation of the Jews. So that's the end of that little section, and clearly shows that Hilberg doesn't know shit about anything except how to just tell his own little fake story. And kind of reality those people live in. So that's the end of that part. Maybe I could get some, you know, back to the list of revision to see if I can boot up that. Just go over some of the names and stuff. It's almost time to wrap things up here. I hope you guys have been enjoying everything here. The wild card. And hope you find this information interesting to some degree. So this is a list of revisionists. I went over Arthur Butts. This one's Keith Christopherson, 1918 to 1997. He's a pioneer revisionist writer and courageous fighter for truth and history. First published a memoir in 1973, relating his wartime experience as a German army officer in Auschwitz camp complex. Quote, during that time I was in Auschwitz, I did not notice the slightest evidence of mass gassings, unquote, he wrote in the Auschwitz Ruga, the Auschwitz Lie. As one of the first important works squarely to confront the Auschwitz extermination legend, Christopherson's firsthand account was a major factor in the growth and development of Holocaust revisionism. So here's a German guy who served in the military during World War II, and by 1973, almost 30 years later, 20 years plus years later, something comes out. The Auschwitz Lie caused an immediate sensation in Germany, where it was soon banned. This, though, did not stop the publication of German language editions in Switzerland and Denmark. However, and before long, editions appeared in all major European languages, including several English. Christopherson predictably came under hostile and mendacious media attack. Until the outbreak of war in Europe, he worked as a farmer in Schleswig, northern Germany. Called to military service, he was badly wounded in 1940 while serving in the Western Campaign. After recuperating and undergoing some specialized agriculture training, he was assigned to a research center in German-occupied Ukraine. There experimentally cultivated a variety of dandelions. Oh, here we go. Thank you so much for joining me. Have a great night. Check out Renegade Tribune and all the other great hosts on the network here.
Here is Majestic Ape, a performer at Comet Ping Pong.
And you all are very grateful that you are below a Subway sandwich shop.
Yes!
And Jerry is known to hang out down here. He likes the world sounds. Tamales.
And little boys.
And children.
I think that was his manager.
No.
Preferences. Investigate Pizzagate.
Come from the land of the ice, of the snow, from the midnight sun when the old trees blow. The hammer